Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 20th of April, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and yes, that's the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For many folks that keep the mainstream biblical calendar, or for those that use the sighted new moon, the Passover feast will be going on right about now, and probably they won't be hearing this live anyway. Regardless, though, it's an important day and weekend for a lot of obvious reasons, as we celebrate what our Creator has done for us. But I also want to note that Friday was 419, and that's a greeting that a good friend of mine has used for a number of years to commemorate a day that really has a lot to do with both tyranny and liberty. But if you have not heard the term, 419, of course, is the date. It's April the 19th. And it represents a date that literally, I guess you could say, no, doesn't live in infamy, but it certainly represents a cusp throughout human history, especially over the last century or so, that has to do with both liberty and tyranny. Most importantly and famously, 419, before we became politically correct, was known as Patriots Day. This was the day of the shot heard around the world. Crispus Attucks took one for the team at Lexington and Concord Green, and of course that began the War for Independence, a.k.a. the Revolutionary War, and it's a dramatic date, a turning point in human history. Years later, there were a number of other things that happened on that date. Chronologically, in modern history, it was the first act of the American Civil War. Lincoln's blockade of the southern ports began on April the 19th, 1861. And, of course, years later still, during World War II, the Nazis made the final attack on the Warsaw Ghetto, part of the final solution, on 419. And most importantly and more recently, we had two major attacks on American, well, constitutional values and liberty. You have the final solution by the Clinton regime and the evil butcher of Waco, then Attorney General Janet Reno, who executed a whole bunch of men, women, and children in their church in Waco, Texas, and then covered up that masterfully with the help of some people who are still involved in Big Brother. And then finally, of course, just a couple of years later, on the very same day, a lot of evidence was destroyed along with a lot of children in Oklahoma City when the Murrah Building was blown up. And guess what? We now have incontrovertible evidence that the truck bomb of Tim McVeigh had not a whole lot to do with it other than being the focus of the cover-up. General Ben Parton, unfortunately the late General Ben Parton, who I had the privilege to meet and interview any number of times, pointed out and did some great articles. By the way, they've mostly been expunged from the web at this point, at least his photographic evidence, showing that there's no way on God's green earth that a single truck bomb even could have remotely done the damage. Clearly, and as a forensic expert, he pointed out, it was contact explosives around the steel-reinforced columns that supported the building. So lots of things happened on 419. And as a fellow talk show host and good friend of mine, Tim Kern, has long suggested it needs to be a greeting, indicating that we understand that this battle for liberty and tyranny continues. And, of course, given all the other things that are coming together this year, it's certainly a day to keep in mind and pay attention. Because any way you slice it, and for so many reasons that we'll talk about over the next few minutes, things are truly coming to a head nowadays that is so consistent with all of what history has shown us before. So let's start off our review of what's been going on with the breathless reports from the waste stream media about the Mueller witch hunt report, finally released. And while it's basically a nothing burger that goes to show you what $25 million no longer buys, unless, of course, you count 2 years wasted and a whole bunch of smokescreen in the interim, that hardly means the caterwauling is over. The most succinct review that I've seen probably came from the president himself, who tweeted that it was, quote, total bullshit. Meanwhile, the British Daily Mail, with a few thousand miles of separation from the worst of the East Coast BS, like the WAPO and New York Times, still represents European political correctness. One of their breathless headlines, among a whole bunch, says, 15 of the most jaw-dropping revelations from the Mueller report, including Hope Hicks hanging up on Putin, Seth Rich being not only dead, but exonerated, Manafort's lost millions, and Don Jr.'s dealings with Booga 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 WikiLeaks. Yeah, they admit there's no concrete evidence in the thing, and most of what they call revelations don't directly even involve the president, but rather the people around him, from his family to his administration. Here are 15, they say, of the most shocking. Oh, yes, folks, I really hope you're sitting down for these. And no, folks, I'm not even going to try to go through all of them, but I will pick on a few of the most inane. Like this one. On October 3rd, 2016, WikiLeaks Twitter sent a direct message to Donald Trump Jr. asking you guys to share a post that alleged Hillary Clinton had, quote, advocated using a drone to target Julian Assange, unquote, which is true, and Trump indicated he'd already done so, but began to talk about WikiLeaks with increasing frequency. Why, WikiLeaks even gave the president's son a link to help in, quote, digging through leaked emails. And I guess you'd have to ask, why shouldn't he? The press wasn't about to. And there's this equally shocking revelation, because then-Canada Trump asked those affiliated with his campaign to help find the 30,000 missing emails. Why not, folks? He'd already asked the Russians on a nationally televised debate, and anybody else that had access to the stuff that Hillary didn't want you to see. Good grief. The report says, quote, Michael Flynn recalled that Trump made this request repeatedly, and Flynn subsequently contacted multiple people in an effort to obtain the emails, including Barbara Ledeen and Peter Smith, states the report and the breathless Daily Mail quote. And here's the question they don't ask. Why shouldn't he? Not only does it go to the heart of the very character he was running against, but it's clearly a matter of national security compromised, even if the FBI and other so-called intelligence agencies have continued to ignore all of that. Here's another shocking revelation under the sub-headline, Hope Hicks Hangs Up on Putin, which says the former White House communications director, Hope Hicks, received a phone call from an unknown Russia man shortly after President Trump's victory on election night. Unsure who it was, she instructed the person to email her, but did hear the words, Putin call. And then the next morning, she received an email from Sergei Kuznetsov, an official at the Russian embassy in the United States, with the subject line, Message from Putin. And it was a message of congratulations for the president-elect. But Hicks declined to pass it along immediately to her boss, asking Jared Kushner instead, can you look into this? I don't want to get duped, but also don't want to blow off Putin. And it turned out the man was Sergei Kislyak. So within days, Kushner and General Flynn were meeting with him at Trump Tower to discuss another meeting and setting up of a secure line between Trump and Putin. Folks, that is standard stuff, and she'd have been a fool not to check it out, especially in what we now know was that poisonous environment. Give me a break. Others in this list are equally inane. I'll get to some of those in a minute when I talk about a far better source. But I do want to mention this one, under the sub-headline, Seth Rich Exonerated. The report, it says, states once and for all, and without a shadow of doubt, well, I guess if you can't trust Robert Mueller, who can you trust? Well, there's always occasional cortex. Anyway, that murdered DNC worker Seth Rich did not help leak emails. Well, what else do you want to know, right? That's what they've been saying, come to think of it. And, of course, there was nothing to see in the murder anyway, or any of the dozens of others who suspiciously sleep with the fishies and certainly won't be blowing any whistles. So move along. And, yeah, let's. I want to start the better summaries with some aggregations of things I saw via Zero Hedge, including a political cartoon courtesy of Michael Ramirez that shows a donkey and an elephant looking at some kind of a Rorschach test, which almost looks like something satanic. The elephant says completely innocent, and the donkey says completely guilty. And underneath the caption reads, the $25 million Rorschach test. And that pretty well nails it. $25 million to waste 2 years, undermine a president who the deep state never wanted elected anyway, and essentially make darn sure that whatever was supposed to happen didn't. Kind of like what Theresa May did with Brexit. Less pithy, perhaps, but more substantially. By far the best summary that I've seen came from the Wall Street Journal's Kimberly Strassel, and I've certainly come to respect her work more and more. And she basically put it this way. What's in the special counsel's findings is almost, but not quite as interesting and revealing as what's left out. And she wrote that basically you've got this 400-plus page report written by a guy who was too conflicted, clearly, to be allowed to do it, much less take a detached look at the Russia collusion story. She doesn't mention it. I have. It is said, and there is evidence to support it more than Mueller found with Trump, that it was, in fact, Mueller who delivered Uranium-1 Yellowcake to the Kremlin on behalf of no less than Hillary and company. And that's no doubt a far bigger deal than anything in this stinking witch hunt report. And, you know, when it comes to Russian collusion, in other words, he ought to know. But, says Strassel, the evidence of the bias now stares at us, whether it's intentional or not, through the 448 pages of the report. What the report shows is that he endured a special counsel probe that was relentlessly, at times even farcically, obsessed with taking him out. And what stands out, if you read it, is just how diligently and creative the legal minds assembled there worked to implicate someone in Trump world on something, anything, Russia. And when it comes to the place where Kimberly Strassel really nailed it, and I can't help but think of Sherlock Holmes and the famous dog that did not bark, and no doubt about it, there are at least one or two dogs that did not bark in this report. Quote, while it wasn't Mueller's intent, the sheer quantity and the banality of the details concerning alleged, even trivial interactions between any Trump official and anybody who was Russian, 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 highlights the fact that they were random, haphazard, and peripheral. By the end of Volume 1 of the Mueller witch hunt here, we get the notion that the Trump campaign engaged in some grand plot with Russia was simply a joke. She goes on to make some other great points, but as I was reading her comments, I couldn't help but think back to a famous quote from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And one of my favorite lines from there is a discussion where one of the sages that she quotes says, "There's no way to rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. Well, when there aren't enough criminals, one makes them, or nowadays we'd say imports them. Ergo, open borders. And one declares so many things to be a crime that it becomes impossible for men to live without breaking laws. And the irony here is that either, for one reason or another, they weren't able to find enough crimes to destroy a sitting president." And that speaks volumes because there are tons of potential crimes. And she even in the article makes a joke about the infamous pit bull Andrew Weissman collapsed under mountains of federal statutes looking for something, anything, to pin on Trump. But here's the rest of it. What she says is most important is what isn't in the report. It only makes a passing, bland reference to the genesis of so many of the accusations that Mueller allegedly probed, like the infamous Steele dossier and the Fusion GPS firm, paid for by the Hillary Clinton campaign. How, for crying out loud, can you exonerate Mr. Page without delving into the scandalous Moscow deeds of which he was falsely accused? How do you narrate an entire section on the July 2016 Trump Tower meeting without noting the fact that Ms. Veselnitskaya was working alongside of Fusion? It certainly stinks to high heaven like a cover-up, and it's definitely the dog that did not bark. Oh, and the Daily Mail, right there from the home of Sherlock Holmes, didn't bark about it either. And we've definitely got to mention this one. Mr. Comey's firing, one of the more telling sections. Mueller's team found it was generally beyond the realm of possibility. Don't even conceive of it. That the FBI director was canned for insubordination or outright incompetence. It treats everything that Comey did as legitimate, just while it treats everything the president did as suspect. And there it is, another dog that did not bark. And it pretty well tells the whole story of the trumped-up witch hunt. That is, if people can see through the Rorschach test issue. From there, we go to the rest of the week in review, more or less chronologically. Starting, of course, with the destruction of a cultural, historic, architectural, and religious icon. National treasure, even. Notre Dame in Paris. And if there's a single symbol of what's being deliberately done to Europe, it was arguably on worldwide display earlier this week. One of the world's most famed cathedrals, Notre Dame in Paris, built in the 12th and 13th centuries, was damaged extensively by fire on Monday, causing the collapse of its dramatic 300-foot-tall central spire, and resulted in the destruction of most of its lead roof as well. Let's go first to the New York Times for their introduction, where they said the extensive fire in Notre Dame Cathedral, symbol of the beauty and history of Paris, quote, bruised the Parisian skies with smoke and further disheartened a city already back on its heels after weeks of violent protests. The spectacle of flames leaping from the cathedral's wooden roof, its spire glowing red and then turning into a virtual cinder, stunned thousands of onlookers who gathered along the banks of the Seine and packed into the plaza of the nearby Hotel de Ville, gasping and covering their mouths in horror and wiping away tears. They then quote Socialist President Emmanuel Macron, who said in a brief but solemn speech on Monday night that the cathedral will be rebuilt, because, quote, this is the place where we've lived all of our great moments, the epicenter of our lives, he said. It is the cathedral of all the French, unquote. And then the Times follows up with the standard narrative at this point. Does it sound familiar? The cause of the fire was not immediately known, said officials, and it seemed almost to be the mantra for the rest of the day, but again, we're used to that. No, nothing to see here. Move along, move along. Not arson, not terrorism. But as close as this story gets is this line. It appeared to have begun in the interior network of wooden beams, many dating back to the Middle Ages, and nicknamed the Forest, said the cathedral's director, Monsignor Patrick Chauvet. Others, however, are expressing skepticism with the official narrative. Here's a piece courtesy of Zero Hedge and the Gatestone Institute, authored by Raymond Ibrahim, under the headline, As Notre Dame Burns, European Churches Are Vandalized, Defecated On, and Torched Every Day. Countless churches throughout Western Europe, the piece begins, have lately seen that fate. In France, two churches are desecrated on average every day. According to Pi News from Germany, 1,063 attacks on Christian churches or symbols, including crucifixes, icons, and statues, were registered in France alone in 2018, which represents a 17% increase compared to the previous year, when only 878 such attacks were registered, meaning things are only going from bad to worse. And here they quote a tweet from Jack Posobiec yesterday, noting that 10 Catholic churches across France were attacked in 1 week recently, according to the UK's Express. And among some of the recent desecrations in France are the following. Vandals plundered Notre Dame des Enfants Church in Nîmes and used human excrement to draw a cross there, along with some other acts of vandalism. The St. Nicholas Church in, I'll probably butcher this, Uge was vandalized on 3 separate occasions. Same thing for St. Elaine Cathedral in Lavar, where vandals desecrated and smashed crosses and mangled the arms on a statue of a crucified Christ in what stories call a mocking manner, while arsonists torched the church of St. Sulpi in Terrace after midday mass on Sunday, March 17th. And similar reports, the stories go, are coming out of Germany, where 4 separate churches were vandalized and or torched in the month of March alone. There's a creeping war, said Pi News in Germany, against everything that symbolizes Christianity. Attacks on mountain summit crosses, on sacred statues by the wayside, on churches, and recently also on cemeteries. And the same German report offers a hint as to who might be responsible, saying that often church doors are smeared with Islamic expressions like Allahu Akbar, and that German reports describe many of the attackers and arsonists as, quote, young Islamists. A story by Kyle Olson at the American Mirror summarizes a lot of the things on the web this way. Allah is grand, Muslims laugh, says the headline, as a blaze destroys Notre Dame Cathedral during Holy Week, and a whole lot of people with Arab-sounding names are finding the historic Notre Dame blaze very funny, including tweets with laughter emojis. As Pamela Geller at the Geller Report notes, if you laughed at a mosque burning, Trevor Noah, Chris Hayes, Rachel Maddow, Don Lemon, and the New York Times, Boston Globe, ABC, NBC, CBS et al. Would be calling for your head. Which brings me to this report from the Daily Caller, informing us that Fox News' Neil Cavuto hung up on Catholic League President Bill Donahue Monday when he refused to stop speculating that the catastrophic fire at Notre Dame could be related to other recent attacks on Catholic churches in Paris and in France. Quote, well, Neil, if it's an accident, it's a monumental tragedy, but forgive me for being suspicious. Just last month, he said, a 17th century church was set on fire in Paris. We've seen tabernacles knocked down, crosses have been torn down, statues, whereupon he was cut off, and Cavuto said, we don't know that. So if we can avoid what your suspicions might be, I do want to look at what happened now, he said, cutting off his guest. And that, too, folks, kind of summarizes the lack of actual discussion about what really happened there. Maybe you could call it another dog that not only didn't bark, but's clearly been muzzled. And come to think of it, that's kind of like what they're trying to do to Julian Assange, too. In particular, it's sending a message to investigative journalists everywhere that there are certain things you'd just better not investigate. And the list is growing. There was a big story in the Denver area over the last couple of days. Your host chose not to talk about it until it was all over for reasons that I hope will be obvious in just a couple of minutes. Hundreds of Denver area schools, said a local piece from the Denver Compost, closed as what they called a massive manhunt continues for an armed woman, an 18-year-old Florida girl, quote, infatuated with Columbine. The FBI and local police, says the subheading here, are searching, or at least were searching, for an 18-year-old Florida woman named Sol Tais, who is said to be armed and extremely dangerous. So, as a result, most Denver area school districts and others across the Front Range, from north to south, canceled classes on Wednesday, including the Denver Public Schools, Douglas County School District, Aurora, Jeffco, and others, over what the districts, at least, called credible threats. Yeah, let me put it this way. Booga, booga, booga. Be afraid, be very afraid, because one woman armed with a shotgun in a bunch of disarmed school districts can do who knows what. You'd think, folks, there would be an obvious solution here, but that, of course, is not what anybody is going to allow to happen. In a maximally politically correct area where gun-free killing zones have been set up to make exactly this kind of thing oh so possible. If anything, the Daily Mail headline from, yes, across the pond was even more hysterical. Armed and extremely dangerous 18-year-old girl infatuated with Columbine massacre may be behind a terrifying online journal, says the banner headline, that demands its readers be killers, as the FBI has closed all Denver schools and launched a manhunt. Because just days before the 20th anniversary of the mass shooting at Columbine High School, coming up on Saturday, April 20th, this Miami-area high school senior flew to Denver and bought a pump-action shotgun. At this point, your cynical host might suggest that this may have more to do with the recently passed, oh-so-unconstitutional abomination called ERPO, or the Red Flag Gun Laws, and don't we need a demonstration of why that's oh-so-important so that we can disarm the rest of you, too? In other words, more gun ban propaganda than it does another wandering nutcase coming to a gun control mecca on an anniversary that, by the way, includes Hitler's birthday, how appropriate as well. And while I'm thinking of it, one more thing that kind of helps to make that point. Remember how it was that back before all the recent and successful attempts at gun control via red flag theft, it was evil black guns that they called assault rifles, like AR-15s, that were the target of the banners. So that was always the false flag weapon of choice. Hey folks, looks to me like shotguns are next on the agenda. Well anyway, what's the news as of Thursday? Yeah, the 18-year-old woman authorities say made a credible threat to the gun-free killing zones known as Denver Area Public Schools is dead. But none dare call it Arkanside. And the FBI confirmed later Wednesday that Sol Pais was found dead, but didn't immediately explain just how it happened. Just that a jogger saw a, quote, naked woman matching her description with a gun running through the woods on Wednesday, and that later Pais was discovered by FBI officials with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Yeah, nothing suspicious here, except maybe the timing. If you realize, of course, that the criminally oath-breaking governor of Colorado just signed into law another complete violation of more parts of the Constitution than I could even recount in the time remaining, from the Second Amendment to the concept of due process to the very idea of owning property at all, the Red Flag Laws, which basically say if somebody claims you're a nutcase, as the president put it, we'll come take your guns first and worry about the law later. Some Colorado sheriffs, of course, think the law still matters. They took an oath, after all, and even have integrity, too. So isn't it convenient that the state got an immediate booga, 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 be afraid, be very afraid demonstration? Almost like a Jedi mind trick.
How long have you had these droids?
About 3 or 4 seasons.
They're up for sale if you want them.
Let me see your identification.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
He can go about his business.
You can go about your business.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
So here we have it. In a week where we find out that certain questions should never have been asked in the first place, because everything about them was a lie from the get-go, we're also being told, whether you like it or not, that there are other questions that cannot be asked, or else. And guess which ones are important, and which ones aren't. And right now, the break is important, too, so we'll be right back.
Yesterday, and I'll get on my knees and pray.
Welcome back, and 419 as well. I'm your host, Mark Call. And even though it's 420, we still need to remember the importance of this time of the year, from the biblical events to the diametric opposites, like Adolf Hitler's birthday and Columbine. But the point is that on so many fronts, this is clearly a time of major changes, for good or for ill. All right, well, what else is going on that's being drowned out in leftist tears, recriminations, and angry table pounding? Well, of course, if the coup from inside fails, there's always that continuing invasion from without. Via Fox News and the American Thinker, the mayor of Yuma, Arizona, right there on the border, has declared a local state of emergency due to the flood of migrants now being released from custody who are literally overwhelming his city, and he's asking the federal government for help. Yuma Mayor Douglas Nichols said the crisis is overtaxing the small city's ability to care for the flood of released illegal immigration detainees, many of them families who have filled these shelters to capacity and beyond, with still more coming every day. As the American Thinker puts it, the situation grows worse by the day. Border towns like Yuma may be doing the best they can, but because sanctuary cities won't take the migrants, there's literally nowhere else for them to go. And a broken system simply dumps those released from detention with no thought of where they might go or how to take care of them. Well, I think the thought's been given, folks, and the intent is obvious, once you accept that the goal is so clear. Anyway, says the piece, it's therefore left to cities like Yuma to bear the brunt of congressional stupidity. And furthermore, note that every move made by the administration to address the crisis is being challenged in court by open borders advocates who don't really care about the starving migrants, only about getting as many people across the border and into the system to overwhelm and destroy it as they possibly can. Related quick story, also from Fox News, to emphasize the point, nearly 60,000, quote, known or suspected aliens are being currently held in federal prisons, according to a report obtained by Fox News from the Department of Just Us. G. Zachary Terwilliger, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, joined the Ingram Angle to discuss the DOJ's findings and noted that, quote, criminal aliens make up 21% of those in the Federal Bureau of Prisons custody and 38% of those in the custody of U.S. Marshals. And note, folks, the qualifier there is federal custody, not counting state and local. Furthermore, he said a staggering amount of resources are being diverted to fighting illegal immigration at the expense of other problems, like the rising opioid epidemic and rising crime rates in a number of areas. And maybe the connection there should be obvious, too. This, too, is interesting, in part because of the source as well. Trump's army, says a headline from the Daily Mail out of the UK, more than 300 asylum seekers, a.k.a. illegal immigrants, surrendered to an armed militia of New Mexico residents, veterans, and ex-cops after stealing across the U.S. border. The group calls themselves, says the Daily Mail with no small amount of surprise, United Constitutional Patriots. One of the militia, Jim Benvey, recorded a video of the migrants trying to enter the U.S. on Tuesday. The group then handed themselves in. The Border Patrol arrived to process them. And then, of course, standard disclaimer said they don't condone the group's actions, which means the president needs to step in and activate them, since they're not managing to get the job done otherwise. The emergence of what the Daily Mail calls vigilante groups comes amid a boom in asylum seekers aiming to make their way into the U.S. through New Mexico and the El Paso sector, among all kinds of other places. And the bigger problem, of course, is, given what's been done with the law, once they make it across, it's all over but the shouting and the inevitable. Here we change gears, but still on the you've heard it before and now you're hearing it again front, behold the sh** map. Says a piece authored by Adam Andreyewski via Forbes and relayed, courtesy of Zero Hedge, mapping San Francisco's, well, let's just say 100,000-plus cases of human feces.
By many measures, says the author, San Francisco is, I think the past tense is more appropriate here, was a world-class city. It's a tourist mecca. It boasts 25 million visitors annually, home to wonders of the modern world, from the Golden Gate Bridge to its iconic cable cars, as well as all kinds of powerful nutcase progressives, including Nancy Pelosi, the communist governor of California, Gavin Newsom, and the former attorney general of that state, now sadly U.S. Senator, wanting to do the same thing to the United States that she's already helped do to California, Kamala Harris. But the city itself, says the author, is in trouble. Hey, no doubt about it, because today, he says, San Francisco boasts an estimated homeless population of 7,500 people. Other reports, and we'll get there in just a minute, say far more. And yes, he notes, affluent sections of the city have become dangerous, with everything from open-air drug use, tens of thousands of discarded needles, and even, yes, you already knew it, human feces galore. Even includes a satellite map of the number of reported cases, and suffice it to say, the entire peninsula is basically brown. The rest of the story goes into the gory, and thankfully you can't smell it, details, pretty much neighborhood by neighborhood. But the bottom line is this. As of the turn of the 20th century, San Francisco was called the Paris of the West. Locals called it the Golden City. Pardon the expression, but lately there's been a brownout in the Bay Area. And San Francisco politicians, hypocritically, have been among the most vocal proponents of reducing income inequality across the nation, which may perhaps be a noble endeavor, says the author, but their struggle should start closer to home. Yeah. Author Michael Snyder, at the Economic Collapse blog, is less kind. He writes that San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Seattle are three formerly beautiful West Coast cities that have now literally been transformed into hell holes, which is a politer but perhaps less appropriate term than the president once used to characterize other third world locales. I know it's hard to believe today, he begins, but once upon a time, millions of people eagerly moved out to the West Coast for a better quality of life. Sadly, the reverse is true today. Millions are moving away from major left coast cities because they've become literal hell holes. A former Seattle police officer, recently interviewed by a reporter from KOMO News, was very honest about the fact he'd never want to raise a family in Seattle because of, well, yeah, the fact that it's become a hell hole. Every night, he said, he saw the worst of Seattle firsthand, and he finally felt forced to quit because city officials wouldn't allow him to effectively do his job. And an explosion of homelessness, and yes, arguably related, migrant invasions, have fueled a wave of crime, drugs, and human degradation unlike anything we've seen before. And in many cases, law enforcement officials have had their hands tied, and they're being prevented from cleaning up the streets. Because of their ultra-liberal policies, writes Snyder, some major left coast cities have become magnets for drug addicts, serial criminals, sex offenders, illegal immigrants, and people that have simply heard about all the wonderful free benefits that are being offered. And as a result, the streets of those cities have become a showcase for the societal decay now sweeping out of there and across the nation. Let's start, he says, with San Francisco. And he quotes a report saying it's home to more than 28,000 homeless people, and that would make San Francisco the city with the third largest homeless population in the United States. But, of course, it's exceedingly difficult to count all the homeless who, in many cases, don't want to be counted. What we do know, though, is that San Francisco is a huge magnet for drug addicts, and the city handed out 5.8 million free syringes in 2018, which would tend to suggest a homeless population far in excess of merely 28,000. Certainly a lot more than 7,500, as Forbes is touting. In any case, it seems all those drug addicts aimlessly wander through the streets, while many of them use those same streets as their personal toilets. He quotes some similar numbers that I'm not going to repeat. But in addition to the endless piles of poop, the drug addicts are also endlessly committing property crimes in order to pay for their drug habits. But at least in San Francisco, they'll find a lot of basically willing victims already pre-disarmed for the home invasions. Each year, notes Snyder, there are more than 6,000 property crimes per 100,000 San Francisco residents, which is a rate four times that of even New York City. The mayor claims to want to get some of the homeless people off the streets, but there's a problem in the NIMBY state finding a place to put them. Residents of one wealthy leftist neighborhood are currently fighting like mad to keep a proposed homeless shelter far away from their gated mansions. Wealthy liberals have set up a GoFundMe campaign to stop Mayor London Breed's project, which has already hit 80% of its $100,000 target. And no, says Snyder, things aren't any better in Los Angeles. They've got nearly twice as many homeless people as San Francisco. It's surged 75% in 6 years. And arguably, almost as many leftists. And further up the left coast, the city of Seattle is experiencing similar issues. Not too long ago, he says, a veteran Seattle reporter named Eric Johnson produced an hour-long documentary entitled Seattle is Dying, which Snyder heartily recommends you take the time to watch. As Max Lavo reviews the video, he points out, it's pretty easy to see where Seattle continues to go wrong. A heavy tax burden, regulations that push out businesses, and a power-hungry group of totalitarian sociopaths at the top continue to slowly erode the city, and the decay of Western civilization can be seen up and down the entirety of the left coast. Some say it's by design, others disagree, it's just plain old stupid, but the commonality among all is that the cities are being pushed into poverty by the illusions and lies of socialists. Calling Seattle anything other than a leftist paradise, suggests Slavo, would be inaccurate. It has all of the laws the socialists want. Well, folks, I don't know about that yet. You still can't openly kill white males on the streets with impunity, but they're getting closer. Well, anyway, said Slavo, it has all of the laws the socialists want, and yet it's killing itself because of it. And I guess just to put an exclamation point on that, there's this story, courtesy of the Gateway Pundit's Brock Simmons, about the leftist mayor of Seattle who has doubled down and now tells the president, go pound salt. She wants to welcome all the new illegal aliens surging across the border, because evidently they don't have enough lawlessness yet. Nor do they have San Francisco's feces, but they're working on it. While other sanctuary city mayors are pushing back against the president's plan to grant their wish, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan openly welcomes and invites the president to do just that, saying in an op-ed for the WAPO, quote, Seattle is not afraid of immigrants and refugees. No, folks, they're afraid of guns, honest citizens, and the Constitution and Bill of Rights of the formerly free United States. And I really wasn't going to quote this piece of tripe, but there's one paragraph in here that's just too precious not to. Call it leftist irony writ large. Ask the leftists, quote, what does scare us? A president and federal government that would seek to weaponize a law enforcement agency to punish perceived political enemies. A would-be despot who thinks the rule of law does not apply to... Oops. She said him. I think she should have said her. And doesn't that just pretty well tell the story? But if you missed that point, here's the final part of this that I'll quote. We will not allow any administration, she claimed, to, quote, use the power of America to destroy the promise of America, unquote. No, we're doing a pretty blankety-blankin' darn good job of that right here on the left coast. Can't you see? And as we mentioned in the first segment, both on the left coast and in so many other red flag states across an increasingly red country, private citizens owning guns simply doesn't serve the state. Neither anymore does a free press and investigative journalism, and more people are rising up and making that point, like Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who puts it this way via LouRockwell.com, the fake charge against Julian Assange proves that the U.S. government simply has no integrity. In a relatively lengthy piece, some of which outlines information we've already been exposed to, he starts this way. Let's be sure we understand. Assange is not charged with anything related to Russia or Russiagate or even breaking the law. He's charged with being in a conspiracy with Manning to, quote, commit computer intrusion, which is not to say that Assange succeeded in hacking a government computer and obtaining classified information. It merely says that Assange discussed the possibility with Manning and had an intention to hack a computer, and more likely, he said, even this non-crime is an invention of prosecutors instructed to indict Assange in the absence of any actual evidence. Hey, we're long past evidence in America with a K, folks. It simply, says Dr. Roberts, all they could come up with. And as a result, it's impossible to respect the indictment. It is, he says pretty bluntly, the product of evil.
And that evil indictment is a direct assault on the First Amendment to what was once called the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. Those who've brought this false charge, he says, and hey, this sounds new, doesn't it, have violated their oath to protect the Constitution from enemies foreign and abroad. And it's the enemies at home we obviously have more now to be concerned about. And the very fact that Assange hasn't been charged with hacking a government computer makes the case that the government hasn't got any evidence to begin with. And furthermore, he notes, and he's not alone, the charge against Assange has nothing to do with the leak of the emails that revealed that Hitler stole the Democratic presidential nomination from Bernie Sanders. People like William Binney have already proven that the Democrat emails were downloaded to a thumb drive, not hacked over the Internet, because the timestamps prove the bandwidth simply isn't capable of that. The alleged rape charges from Sweden are equally bogus and have been proven for almost a decade to be exactly that. Says Dr. Roberts, he was never charged with raping anyone. He's broken no law. He's just a journalist who did nothing but what the New York Times did when they published the leaked Pentagon Papers and some of the leaked documents for which Assange has been arrested for publishing. He's being framed on a false nonsense charge because the U.S. government has to protect its own criminality, and it's moving to destroy the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and they've practically already succeeded. This is, quote, Western democracy, concludes Dr. Roberts, as it really is. We should be ashamed that we, the people, have permitted the U.S. government to degenerate into such criminality and barbarity. Dr. Ron Paul observes that Assange is simply a political prisoner, and that last week's attack on Assange by the British government under a U.S. extradition order is an attack on all of us, as well as the Constitution and the free press. It's an attack on free speech, he said. It's an attack on our right to know what our government is doing with our money in our name. And like famous political prisoners before him, Assange is now in jail because he told the truth about government. Repressive governments, says Dr. Paul, don't want their citizens to know what they're up to, so they insist on controlling the media. And now, don't forget, they have public-private partners like Gulag and Two Facebook to help. Assange, he says, is the canary in the coal mine, warning us something is very wrong with our system. In part, he notes, because the U.S. waste stream media seems to want to do nothing but the bidding of its masters in the U.S. government. As long as Assange is in prison, concludes Dr. Paul, we're all in prison, and we no longer live in a free society. Bottom line, they want Julian Assange to disappear so that there might not be a next Assange, or at least they'll think twice before informing us of our government's crimes. And Tom Luongo is one of those who finds the timing of this incident, too, more than a bit suspicious. Just look at what happened last week in less than 24 hours. First, there was Teresa, a.k.a. the snake oil lady May, who kicked 17.4 million voters into the weeds, and then she turns right around and oversees the arrest and quick judgment of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. All of which is important beyond dovetailing it with her Brexit betrayal. They had to go after Assange now, suggests Luongo, because Theresa May's time in office is ending. And a Jeremy Corbyn-led government, for all of his faults, wouldn't grant the U.S. its prize. All of this, though, suggests Tom Luongo, as a narrative, is just too convoluted, so it might not work. You simply can't scream, Trump is a Russian agent, for three straight years, and then backfill a guilt-by-association charge on him via Julian Assange and concoct this vast right-wing conspiracy, to quote the witch herself, to deny St. Hitlery the presidency. But sadly, that's exactly what they seem to want to do. The proof is, Hitlery herself is weighing in on the subject, gloating that Assange will now, quote, have to answer for what he has done, unquote. Yes. I like to put it this way, folks.
Hey, you cursed rat! Look what you've done! I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world! What a world! Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness? Ah!
And worse, suggests Luongo, Assange is now going to be used to distract us for another year and a half through next year's election, present as a ghost like Paul Manafort, but silenced via gag orders, solitary confinement, and judicial prerogative. Ultimately, it's all a last-ditch effort, he says, to stitch together a narrative to keep Russia, Russia, Russiagate alive and protect everyone in both the U.S. and U.K.'s so-called intelligence agencies that were involved in the still-ongoing coup attempt. And if Trump hadn't already caved on that front, in other words, if his plan had been to use Assange to get Hillary and, famously, another broken promise, lock her up, he would have gotten him out of the UK ages ago, and he wouldn't be channeling Sergeant Schultz today.
I know nothing.
And I like Tom Luongo's conclusion, connecting the various UK and US dots. It's not about justice, he says, and that ought to be obvious. It's about protecting the empire. And just like Brexit has become about keeping the UK a vital part of the new, soon to be hot, but currently cold war against Russia, a Britain free of the EU would be capable of independent Russian relations. And it'd be subject to the whims of the British general election cycle, and not under the thumb of the unelected European Commission, which is why he says, I'm convinced there's a Brexit angle to the timing here. No, this isn't about Trump now being free to go after Hitlery, because the Mueller witch hunt report has finally been issued. No, this is about shoring up the empire after an existential brush with the truth. And like the entire Russiagate narrative itself, all of these government trolls are focused on the threat to their own security, their ability to operate in the shadows, performing horrific acts of violence with our money, and in our name. And the approved media, those they control, are now shifting the discussion away again from the crimes they don't want to see exposed, distracting us with how this happened, not what was exposed. And while the maintenance crew may be working overtime now, Luongo at least ends on a high note. He says, I'm confident that this mess is too big even for them to clean up and cover up. Everything we're seeing here are symptoms of a much deeper revolt against the empire, because now we can see them for what they are. And while they keep trying to win the battles, they're losing the war of hearts and minds. Which seems to make this an appropriate way to wrap up, one twisted way or another.
Remember the Gatwick Airport in London being droned? Nearly 4 months have passed, says the story via Zero Hedge, since sightings of drone activity above the runway at London's Gatwick Airport prompted a 33-hour shutdown that left some 140,000 travelers stranded right in the middle of the holiday rush. Yet investigators appear to be no closer to finding the nefarious culprits or other after arresting, then releasing, a middle-aged couple from Crawley. The information vacuum, it says, has been so puzzling, it's inspired speculation, gee, do you think, that there may never have even been a drone, and that the reported sightings were either a ruse or something far more sinister, or maybe a staggering blunder or miscommunication on the part of airport staff. Hey, who knows anymore? And the one thing you can probably count on is you're not going to get an honest summary from the British police or MI5. Shortly after the airport reopened, continues this story, police told reporters they couldn't even discount the possibility that there never really had been a drone, even though they've since claimed that the drones were very real and that the culprit probably acted with, quote, malicious intent. But now, the BBC notes the narrative has changed again. Gatwick's COO has told that organization that the drone's pilot, quote, seemed to be able to see what was happening on the runway, and that the attack might have actually been an inside job. Sussex police confirmed that the possibility of an insider's involvement has become a credible line of inquiry. Because either the person piloting the drone could see what was happening on the runway, or may have been eavesdropping on secure radio communications. Either way, says Gatwick COO Chris Woodruff in his first interview since the incident, it was clear that the drone operators had a link into what was going on at the airport. And furthermore, whoever orchestrated the attack, if there was one, also used a drone that could evade detection by the DJI Aeroscope drone detection system, which the airport had been testing at the time. And Woodruff specifically and categorically dismissed speculation that there might not have been a drone, saying it was ridiculous, arguing that the drone had been spotted by more than 150 people, although, strangely, none of these eyewitness reports have made it into the public record. I guess I do have to give him this one, folks, because if you remember the shoot-down of TWA Flight 800, during the fever of the Clinton re-election campaign a couple of decades back, there were 700 eyewitnesses there, most of whom the FBI completely ignored, and almost all of whom were later denied. Back then, at least, we had good investigative journalists like Jack Cashill, who didn't have to go into exile in an embassy for 7 years to bring people the truth. Anyway, Sussex police say their investigation, such as it is ongoing and that it will probably take months to complete. Just as importantly, and this is how Tyler Durden wraps it up, it's increasingly likely that the public will never know what really happened that day anyway.
And that probably goes for Notre Dame, too, and almost certainly all the real traitors involved in the witch hunt that was used to cover up the real acts of treason. It's all about knowing where to put your trust.